Doesn't go, huh? All right. Thank you very much, Rabbi Skobach. Being here together with you gives me an opportunity to thank you for all the lovely things that you're doing. You actually, if my memory isn't playing tricks on me, you were a scholar in residence in Ottawa a little while ago via JET and made a great impact. The work that you're doing is very important, and as a matter of fact, the topic that we're addressing today is probably accentuated by some of the differences that come to us from other quarters that are not necessarily Jewish. It is a pleasure to be here. You have a very odd idea of pleasure to get up early on Sunday morning to listen to a lecture on pleasure, but I hope it'll be worthwhile. We just had a lesson in pleasure in the form of the generation that led to the destruction of the world that was the Noah experience of yesterday, when we were exposed to a group that was full of chamas, which, by the way, probably has something to do with the name of that terrorist organization that is causing us so much sorrow in our generation. We were exposed to a generation which enjoyed the simple pleasure of making tzuras for other people. They got some sort of a perverse thrill out of doing things which apparently were not justiciable in court. You couldn't take anybody to court for it because it was petty ante stuff. But it could cause all sorts of upset. And they enjoyed doing it. The question is, why did they reach the stage where this is what they were doing? Obviously, it was a world in which there was no direction, there were no rules, there were no fulfillments, there was no Torah to study, there was hardly any opportunities. I would imagine that there weren't any great philanthropic organizations operating at that point in time. And people had too much time on their hands. And the Gemara tells us that betela mevia lidei shi'amum, that having nothing to do leads to destruction. You land up doing destructive things. They had all this time in the world, and they were doing destructive things. The odd thing about it is they probably were having some form of perverse pleasure out of it. Now, today, if I would tell you that you should do anything that makes you feel good, and it's in the context of what happened in that generation, you say, you know, this is obviously ridiculous. You can't tell anybody just to do what feels good, because what feels good may be feeling very badly for the people that are on the receiving end of your, whatever they call, whatever it ticks off makes you feel pleasurable. So we immediately gain the idea from this that merely saying that what is pleasurable is therefore good is wrong. However, to go to the opposite side and to say that whatever is pleasurable has to be by definition bad is also wrong. And as a matter of fact, Judaism in general is replete with all sorts of exhortations and regulations which seem to point in the direction of enjoying life. When you wake up in the morning, the first thing you say is, Moda ani lefanecha melechai v'kayom shechazata b'nishposi b'chemlo rabo emunosecha. Basically, you say, you give thanks to God that your soul has been returned to you, and this was done with great b'chemlo rabo emunosecha, great is your faithfulness. What is your thought as you're saying this? Because different people have different emotions as they're waking up in the morning, such as, oh no, not again, or oy vey, I have to go to work, or what am I going to do today, or I wish I could sleep in. I mean, there are all sorts of different emotions. The one that probably is not likely to be there, although ideally it should be, is, oh great, I have now another opportunity because I had just gone to sleep. I didn't know I was going to wake up in the morning. I have now another opportunity to enjoy God's world and to do some of the good things that I can only do if I'm alive. And I am so delighted that I have this opportunity. Now, how many people actually wake up like that? I don't know. But that's the way, ideally, we should be waking up. We should be waking up to the idea that every day is a day full of opportunity to do good things and to enjoy God's world. Because it would be a little bit ridiculous for God to be playing this game with us where he says, okay, I'm putting you on this world and I have all sorts of things for you to enjoy. But you can't touch any of them. That's not the Jewish way. This is not the way we are supposed to live. We are supposed to gain an appreciation of God's world, see its beauty, experience it, enjoy it, not become obsessed by it, not to abuse it. But certainly the idea that that you cannot serve God mitoch atzvus, you can't serve God in the sense of melancholy. You have to be here to enjoy the world that God has given to us. So just recently we finished a very festive period of Yom Tov, was known as Sukkot, Shmini Atzeret. And in it we have an obligation, v'samachta b'chagecha. We have an obligation, we have to rejoice in the chag. So if I ask you a very simple question, without, let's say, divorce yourself from whatever you know about what the Gemara tells us about this. As you say, okay, what does it mean to enjoy yourself on the chag? Give me some sort of tangible explanation for this. Don't give me some of these nice spiritual stuff, which I'm not discounting. But give me a tangible, what do you mean when you say, v'samachta b'chagecha, you should rejoice in your festival. Not in mine, but in yours. So what exactly is meant by this? Oh, I knew miracles could happen. I'm a chayah. That's pretty good. I didn't even ask for it. Oh, Yasha Kreis, you can have the small one, though, if you want. Okay. So, what would you say? Yeah, you should go to shul, you should daven, you should enjoy shaking the lulav, eating the sukkah, and all this stuff. The odd thing is that we have on this Yom Tov a very peculiar regulation. This is mitztayer, is potter min ha-sukkah. That is, if a person is in pain, he doesn't have to sit in the sukkah. The question of how this extends, whether if you can, the word mitztayer, potter min ha-sukkah, has interesting definitions to it. For example, if it's raining, you don't have to sit in the sukkah. There's a question of, can you do it even if you do feel the pain of it? But the mere construct of this is quite illuminating. Why do you have such a regulation? For example, I mean, it pains me to have to take off from work for Shabbos. Did anybody ever tell me I don't have to, I can be Michal Shabbos? Because it pains me not to be able to watch the television program that I like. Never saw such exemptions with regard to Shabbos. So why is there such an exemption with regard to Sukkot? My theory, which obviously you have a right to question, is that we take so seriously the obligation to be happy on the Yom Tov that if there's anything that diminishes from it, then we're not allowed to do it. That there's a serious question here, what happens when the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah can conflict with the idea of being happy on the Yom Tov. So the Torah says, hold it a minute. Or the halacha comes out that the obligation to be happy on the Yom Tov actually trumps the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah. Because so important is it that you should feel the joy of the Yom Tov, you should feel happy on the Yom Tov, that we cannot possibly fathom you're doing something like sitting in the sukkah with the rain falling down your back and falling into your soup, and you're feeling happy about it. So if it really causes you this pain, to say, stay home. Don't enjoy. Because it must have bothered you throughout the ages. Why all of a sudden you have this exemption with regard to Sukkot? So it's my feeling that it's because of this clash. And interestingly, the explication of the clash is not too bad, folks. The mitzvah is there. You got to sit in the sukkah whether it pains you or not. The ultimate trumping value here, the one that becomes out triumphant, is the obligation you have to be happy. V'samachta. But what about the tangible essence? What is the ingredient of a samachta that we're talking about? What is it really that we're supposed to be celebrating? So, I mean, I would be afraid if I were given an exam and I knew nothing and they were saying to me, okay, here you have this construct. It said you have to be happy on this Yom Tov. Give me what in your mind is the definition of this. I would be embarrassed to write what the Gemara tells me. Because the Gemara tells me the Ein Simcha Ela V'Bosa V'Yayin, that the joy of Yom Tov is experienced through eating meat and drinking wine. I tell you, I would be embarrassed to write this. But now that it's there, I'm proud. Because you know what the Torah is telling us? Listen, Judaism, the way of the Torah is to enjoy the world, to enjoy the best of what God has given to us, to enjoy meat and wine, which were obviously not basic staples. I think it's one of the lamentable components of our generation that meat has become a part of our diet that we eat regularly. It is, to me, a little bit depressing that when you call an airline to order a kosher meal for a flight, that invariably there's only one airline in the world that I know of, at least that flies in North America, that will offer you the option of a non-meat meal. And that's El Al. Every other airline says, hold it, folks, we only have one kosher meal, and that's meat. That's odd. Because how can you expect, can you imagine, let me put it into context, can you imagine a person eating chult every day of the week and then actually enjoying chult on Shabbos? It's an impossibility. I mean, if you have it every day, you can't. What the Torah says, therefore, v'samachta b'chagecha, that it means simchas boso v'yayin, obviously they weren't eating meat every day. This was a delicacy. And what the Torah is telling us is we don't want you to get the idea that celebration with HaKadosh Baruch Hu means divorcing from God's world. That's not what it's all about. What it means is ennobling God's world. Taking those lovely ingredients that God has given to us and placing upon them the imprint of sanctity and spiritualizing even the eating of meat and the drinking of wine. Rambam puts it in a fascinating context because he mentions that if someone takes, you know, you can take this to the extreme. So, for example, if someone says, oh, okay, so the mitzvah of Yom Tov is to celebrate with Bosa V'Yayin, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go to the extreme. I'll lock myself in my room on Yom Tov and I'll have all sorts of lovely dishes and I'll enjoy them. But no one else is invited. It's just me, myself, and whoever it is, let's say my wife, my kids, that's it. The Rambam makes a very interesting observation. This is not a simcha of Yom Tov. This is simchas kreso. This is a simcha of his stomach. What Rambam is saying very clearly is, yeah, there is this obligation, but don't take it as something which is so constricted that, oh, you have this obligation to really get drunk royally and to become overly saturated with the meat that you're eating. What he's saying to you is this is an opportunity to combine physical enjoyments with spiritual fulfillments. And if you can use this as an opportunity to share with others, then what we have here is a true pleasure. In our generation, we are desperately trying to find the things that will bring us fulfillment. You have books upon books, gurus upon gurus, that are giving us all sorts of insights into finding yourself, fulfilling yourself, all sorts. There's an estimate of about 150 selfist schools that are around today that deal with the issue of self-fulfillment, finding yourself. And this is, by the way, a society who's founded on the idea of life, liberty, maybe not in Canada, and the pursuit of happiness. There is no evidence that in this penchant and this pursuit of happiness that we have actually given birth to a happier society. On the contrary, we have a generation in which 70% of the population admits to being at one point or another very lonely. Lots of people think that the big ideal for life is to have your own private home, right? Which is odd because it's considered the ultimate punishment to be put into solitary confinement. So I guess the question is, if it's your choice to have this happen or if it's imposed upon you, which is actually the greatest value? But we're not a happy society. As a matter of fact, there is evidence in terms of the general feeling of unhappiness. Most people will tell you that at points in time, especially those who are lonely, and loneliness and unhappiness go hand in hand with each other, you really are living in a society where unhappiness probably reigns supreme. So the question, of course, is as follows. If we wanted to go to the moon and we set our mind to it, we put all our energies into it, and we eventually got there. We got to the moon. How come it is that if we set as our goal to go to the moon, we reach the moon? And how come it is that we set as our goal to be happy? Well, the more that we're lurching after it, the more that we're yearning for it, the more that we're desperately seeking it, it seems the less we have it. So where's the problem here? Why are we failing in this? To my mind, one of the major problems is, and Viktor Frankl pointed this out in his writings, happiness is very elusive. You can't run after it. The more you run after it, the more it eludes you. Happiness is not something that you pursue. As he would put it in his terse terms, happiness is something that ensues. You don't go after it. The more you ever say, for example, you want to have leisure time, you want to enjoy yourself, and somehow or other, the more energy you put into it and the more anxious you become about it, the worse it actually is. It never becomes the thing that you're really looking forward to. There are certain things in life that you simply cannot pursue on their own, that they have to come naturally. In other words, we as human beings, and this is something sort of built into the human clock, we don't become happy on the basis of causality. We become happy based on reasons, not on causes. Let me give you an interesting example, which Viktor Frankl himself brings in one of his very interesting pieces. He says there was an experiment that they had done, Olds and Milner, an experiment that they did with rats. The experiment they did was as follows. They wanted to see how rats would behave if they attached electrodes to the brain. And they attach basically electrodes to the brain, and they're able to get the pleasure sensation where if the rats, let's say, pressed a lever, a shot would come to the brain, and they would have the sensation as if they had just had a full meal. So they got the rats to actually do this. Every time the rat was hungry, all it had to do was press this button, and it felt like it had a full course meal. Now you're beginning to say, oh, yeah, this would be a great diet, right? Don't have to worry about eating. if I really want to, because really it's not the food that really is the issue. We want to have the sensation that we're full. So that would be actually better than any diet anybody could devise. You just have a button in your pocket, and whenever you're feeling hungry, you push the button, and presto, you feel as if you've just had a full meal. You don't have to worry about brocha to make. I mean, this is an interesting thing. Probably all sorts of shyness that can come out of this. Whether you'd have to make, if you actually felt as if you had a full course meal, would you have to make the brocha before you push the button? And then what type of brocha achrona do you make? I mean, this could be all sorts of problems, but you don't have to worry about it because that diet's not going to, that's not going to carry the day. And the reason why is interesting. When they gave these rats these levers and actually did it, so after 3 days, the rats died from starvation. You know why? Because they had nothing in their system. They thought that they were satisfied, but they really weren't. Now, what was happening here was something quite fascinating. They had causes to feel full, but not reasons. They had causes, but not reasons. Those are very important distinctions. The same is true of happiness. You can cause people to be happy, but that doesn't mean they have reasons to be happy. So, for example, what's the ideal cause? You can give them wine, make them delirious. You can, in our generation, what they've chosen is crazy, debilitating, and harmful drugs. Ecstasy. You take a pill, ecstasy, you feel like you're on cloud 9 or cloud 78 or whatever you may be, and you feel great without realizing that what has happened is you're no different than you were 10 minutes earlier. You have no cause, you have no reason to be happy, you're just causing it. But is there any reason to justify your feeling like this? Have you done things that have made you feel fulfilled so that this happiness can ensue? Absolutely zero. You just become more absorbed in yourself. And that hasn't evolved into anything meaningful. Think about something which is so important to all of us. It's the wedding ceremony, the chuppah. And we have this weird institution which is part of the chuppah, which is the breaking of the glass. And most of us think, and I'm not saying it's erroneous, it's true that there's a connection to Eretz Yisrael in this. It's a connection to Yerushalayim, to the Churban Beis HaMikdash, to the destruction of the Holy Sanctuary. There's no question that this is all part of it. But if you study the Gemara, the basic reasoning for it is related to an episode. There was an interesting episode. The sages came to a wedding, and they saw that people had gotten drunk. So they basically took a very expensive crystal, and they smashed it on the dance floor to sober everybody up all of a sudden. They said, what's going on over here? The Chachamim are taking an expensive crystal and they're smashing it on the floor? Yeah, because they realized that people were stoned. And the message that was coming through is, yes, we do want you to be happy at weddings, but we don't want this to be a happiness that comes from your artificially putting something into you that makes you happy. We want this to be a happiness where the next day when you wake up, you remember what happened the day before. We want this to be a happiness which is a serious and a sober happiness, which is rooted not in causes, but is rooted in reasons. And what's the reason we want you to be happy? We want you to be happy at the happiness that somebody else is experiencing. We want you to be b'sameach choson v'kala. We want you to make them happy, and we want you to be happy by virtue of the fact that you have generated happiness in others. We want you to get your pleasure that way. We want to build a society in which people gain their greatest meaningful fulfillment by bestowing it upon others. This is what it's all about. Some people have often wondered why it is that on the moment when the bride and groom are the happiest in their lives, that we have an obligation to make them happy. very interesting question. Because I would say, for example, if you really want to do something to make someone happy, go find somebody out there who's very sad and tell them a few jokes or tickle them or spend a few meaningful moments with them to lift up their spirits. But why you have this situation here? They're happy already. They get married. So what are you bothering with them for? Go make somebody who is sad happy. And by the way, not to say that it's an either-or situation, because truthfully, the idea that we need to make happy those who are sad is an essential Jewish fulfillment. The Gemara in Ta'anit tells the famous story of Eliyahu, who was accompanied by a few members of the Chazal, great sages, and they were saying, okay, in this great gathering over here, who is worthy of Olam Haba? And finally it came down to two clowns who were worthy of Olam Haba, because their job was to lift up the spirits of the downtrodden. Those who were unhappy, they lifted up their spirits. And these are the people of the Olam Haba. So I don't want to diminish the Olam Haba propensities of people like Jay Leno and David Letterman and others. But the point of the matter is we can all be such clowns. It doesn't mean we have to put on masks and things like that. We can do things to make other people happy. But why, Bedavka, do we ask people to do this in a situation where we assume that the bride and groom are happy? Truth is that although on the surface the bride and groom are happy, deep down they're scared. Deep down they're scared. If they know what's happening now, that they're getting married, and all of a sudden, everything that had been taken care of for them is now their responsibility. All of a sudden now, they're thrust into the world where they have to make a living, they have to keep the house, they have to pay the rent, they have to buy the groceries, they have to make sure that they can make ends meet. They are on their own. I mean, there are obviously exceptions to this in terms of the configuration I just outlined to you, but technically speaking, when a bride and groom get married, they are scared. And they have, in front of them, right after they're getting married, is a life full of responsibilities that they have not lived up until now, most of the time. So we have an obligation to make them happy. We have an obligation at that point in time, because on the surface, they may look like they're happy. And they are definitely, we would hope, happy to have each other. But in the mix, there's also lots of anxiety. So we have an obligation to share that with them. We have an obligation to hold their hand. We have an obligation to show them as a community that we're not going to let them go. That we consider it our obligation to make sure that they are happy. Which is why we also have this interesting residual component to the wedding, which I don't think is in any way, shape, or form emulated in any other religion. And that is the idea that after the wedding, you have Sheva Brachot. That is to say, not just the day of the wedding, because what happens in most instances is the bride and the groom, in secular society for sure, lamentably in some instances even in Jewish society, the day after the wedding, they zip off to Hawaii or to who knows where, Europe, Vesich, and they go anywhere, instead of facing the realities that are in front of them. Where did this come from, this great escape? I think that subconsciously they realized that there was this tremendous responsibility that marriage is all about, and they wanted to run away from it almost immediately before they came back to it. But we are much more realistic. We say, look, hold it. This is it. You have now an obligation to be with each other, not to run away anywhere, to be exactly where you're supposed to be. And we as a community, we're saying to you, we are with you. We're going to be there, not only the day of the wedding, when you have this big, lavish gathering, but even in the smallness of the days after, which are in some instances not so small. Nevertheless, we're going to be there with you because we realize that you have worries, and we are part of that community. So much so, for example, there's some interesting regulations concerning the obligations that husband has to wife and wife to husband over the course of the first week, over the first year, in terms of not running away from each other, in terms of according to Sefer Achinuch, being mevater doesn't even come to the question. For example, if the wife says to the husband, I know that lahalocha, you're not going to leave me for a night during the first year, but I, you know, it's fine, you can go. So most authorities say that this is considered okay, and if she is okay with it, he can leave. The Sefer Chinuch says absolutely not. And the reasoning behind it is that marriage, and this is something which, again, is not some culturally, this is a real revolution for people who are not within the context and framework of the way Judaism works. Marriage is not ours. Marriage belongs to the community. And the happiness of a married couple is not simply the right of the couple themselves. It's the responsibility of the community. It's the greater responsibility of everybody. And even the couple can't make compromises on this because it's the community that has a stake in it. So in effect, for example, for the husband to say to the wife, for the wife to say to the husband or whatever, you can go for one night or whatever it is where you have to go, they have to consult the community because the community says, hold it a minute. This is, it's our well-being that's at stake here too. It's all of us. We're in this together. So you have to ask not only your mate, you have to ask the whole community. I know it's a mishigas. I know it sounds crazy, but this is the type of mentality that gives birth to the very same, shall we say, expression of wanting to make the bride and groom happy. There's a tremendous difference between a religious wedding and a non-religious wedding in terms of the dancing. And this is something which it may not be such a big issue in Toronto. It's an issue in hick towns like Ottawa and other places. We have a new premier from a hick town. That's a Mahaya. The idea, what's the difference between mixed dancing and separate dancing? So we say, oh, you know what? There is a difference because in mixed dancing, you're dancing with your wife and other, you know, let's not blind our eyes. In many instances of mixed dancing, it's not only with your own, but with others, and there's interchanges. And in separate dancing, you're dancing without any gender-related problems. You're dancing with your own. But that misses the point. The point of the matter is that if you're dancing, social dancing with your mate at a wedding, what really is happening is you're saying as follows. This couple have gotten married, and I'm not going to have an opportunity to enjoy a good meal, and I'm going to dance with my wife. But the whole idea behind this is your focus has to be on the bride and the groom. You're not here to have a good time with your wife. You're not here to have a good time with your spouse. You're here to make sure that the bride and groom have a sense of joy transmitted to them by you. This is your obligation. So this idea, yes, there are layers of tzniut that get into it. There's no question about it. The question is modesty. But the essential idea that is behind all this is in terms of where's the focus? The focus is on gladdening others. The focus in this instance is on gladdening the bride and the groom. And whatever pleasure we're coming out from here is not in terms of, oh, did I have a good time? I hate it when I hear this. You had a good time. It was not for you to come here to have a good time. It was for you to come here to make sure that the bride and groom had a good time. And if you're telling me that you had a good time because you made them feel good, and that's what gave you fulfillment, that's great. But I'm not sure that most people, when they say this is what they mean. That they gave somebody else a good time. So even this simple little thing, like the marriage construct and the breaking of the glass and how we do it and why we do it, is to accentuate this difference. That We're here not to pursue pleasure because that's an elusive thing. The more we pursue it, the less we're going to have it. We're here to pursue meaning. Not that meaning is so easy to attain. But where your focus in whatever you're doing is not me, but the world out there, then there's much more likelihood that you're going to come out of it happy. Not because you're focused on it, but because you have reasons. There are reasons to make you happy. Take, for example, a very interesting legislation. In the Torah, it says that a Kohen coming into the Beis HaMikdash is not allowed to be a Shosu Yayin. He can't be under the influence. Now, we know that wine is a very good thing. Yayin Yisamach Levav Enosh. David HaMelech testifies to this, that wine makes people happy, right? We also have an obligation to serve God in joy, right? Ivdus Hashem b'simcha. So it would seem to me that the confluence of these two psukim, these two verses, would lead to the inescapable conclusion that it should be an obligation for every single Kohen to drink wine before he goes into the Beis HaMikdash. And yet the Torah tells us just the opposite. That when the Kohen goes into the Beis HaMikdash, he's not allowed to be under the influence. Again, the reason is the differentiation between reasons and causes. Yes, we can generate happiness in the Kohen by triggering that electrode. In the olden days, they did it by having wine. So the wine triggered that electrode. But we want the Kohen. Yes, we want the Kohen to serve joyfully and enjoy, but not artificially. We want the Kohen to actually be happy. Not to cause him to be happy, we want him to be happy, to have a reason to be so. He should be delighted by the fact that he has this opportunity to serve God. This is where the pleasure should be coming from. So I know that this is sort of like a tall order. By the way, what is our ending time? Yeah. Should we go with a few minutes? Yeah. I also want to make another interesting observation. And that has to do with the relationship of privation to pleasure and the shall we say, the impact or the importance of self-denial in Judaism. Take Yom Kippur, for example. We have a pasuk which tells us, V'inisem es nafsho seichem, which many people erroneously translate as meaning that we should afflict ourselves for Yom Kippur, which is Be'erev al Erev, from evening to evening. Is this true? Is this what it means? I firmly believe that there is nothing in the Torah which legislates to us that we have to experience pain or there will be experienced denial. The Gemara tells us very clearly that every single thing that the Torah prohibited, there's an there is, on the other hand, something which allows this to happen. For example, if we're not allowed to eat blood, there's something that's permitted which is exactly like blood, namely the liver. So if we ever get desperate and say, you know what, I yearn for knowing what blood tastes like, I gotta have it. So you have it. If you have this terrible desire to know what pig tastes like, so the Gemara says, not a problem either. There's a certain marrow of a fish that tastes exactly like it. Now, don't be a cynic and say to me, how did the Chazal know this? It's not a big deal. They probably had a goy over there who was a taster, right? It's not a problem. But why did the Gemara go by to this and say, you know what, whatever was forbidden was permitted? And then the Gemara also says to us, you know what, don't develop what's known as Jewish gastronomy, like you have a Jewish stomach that says, I can't stand the taste of pork. That's not the way we should be. We should actually say, I would love it. Well, what can I do? God said no. As a matter of fact, there are some theories abound by the idea that the word for a pig is a chazir, that it's going to be chozer, that it's going to be coming back, and it's going to be in messianic times, it's going to be not post-messianic times, the pig will actually be permitted. See, there are some Jews who actually jumped the gun, they're already living in that generation. But the point of the matter is, why did the sages bother to tell us this? Why did the Chacham tell us this? Only that we shouldn't get obsessed with the idea that merely denying ourselves is a fulfillment. Nothing is a fulfillment on its own, just because of the fact that I abstain from something, that all of a sudden I have fulfilled something. I said, you know, God, look at me. I didn't do this, I didn't do that. And all for your sake. What did you achieve? What did you achieve by this? The Gemara is telling us there is nothing intrinsically magical about denying yourself this, that, or the other. And the proof is that for everything that you deny yourself, we have the counterpoint of something that you can take that is exactly the thing you denied yourself. So let's concentrate for a little bit on Yom Kippur. The Torah says that you have to afflict yourself for 25 hours. The last time I looked, I never found a hungry person in shul on Kol Nidre. I don't know about you. Have you ever met a Jew who came into shul on Yom Kippur and was hungry? Every single Jew comes into shul on Yom Kippur, they are stuffed to the gills. Because they know that there is a mitzvah to fast on the 10th day, and thankfully we also have a mitzvah to eat on the ninth. And in the language of the Gemara, whoever eats on the ninth is considered as if they fasted the ninth and the tenth. So, of course, there are different schools of thought as to why you eat on the ninth. But let's take the one that I like, which is that it's a facilitator. In other words, the more that you eat, up to a certain point, that you eat on the ninth to facilitate your being able to fast on the tenth. This is fine. But where do we fulfill the idea that you have to afflict yourself for 25 hours? It's impossible. If we're going to have such a full meal, a su'uda, right before Yom Kippur, I'm not going to start getting hungry until the next morning. I would imagine most people are like that too. They have a very full meal, then they go to shul. Yom Kippur night, for sure, they're not in any afflicted state. So where's the affliction here? So I would have to therefore say that the inui is not the fact that you're being afflicted, you're not in pain, but you're actually cut off from. You basically have said, food is out of my vocabulary now for 25 hours. And we don't want you to be afflicted, because the more afflicted you are, in the sense that you feel physically deprived to the point where you're faint, how is a weak individual going to give a klap on al-chaytan so weak they'll bowl themselves over? You have to be in good shape on Yom Kippur. You can't do tshuva when you're weak as well as you can do it when you're strong. And you can't concentrate and you can't meditate and you can't fully come to grips with who you are and who you're supposed to be unless you have the energy to do so. So, what the Torah is telling us, eat on the ninth, so you can do this fully on the tenth, because we know that if you start mixing up the food with the spirit, that it may compromise it. So the one day a year, we want you to concentrate fully on it, so we're asking you to deny yourself a little bit, so that you can do this fully. But it's not denial for denial's sake. It is depriving yourself of one thing so that you're able to do the other thing. And this is the message we have to take through in terms of denial. The idea that, no, I didn't do this, that, or the other is nothing in and of itself unless you can say, because of it, I did something else. So, for example, if you can say to me, I skipped one meal, and with the money that I saved, I gave it to a poor person who had nothing to eat, I say, great. This is why the Gemara tells us, Agra de Ta'anisot Tzidkoso, that the value of a Ta'anit is in the Tzedakah that comes. If this experience gives me the idea of what it's like not to have, and that therefore I become more generous and share with others, beautiful. But if it's just to say, God, give me credit because I did this, that, and the other, doesn't work. The famous story of a fellow who once came to a rabbi. He wanted smicha. He wanted rabbinic ordination. So he asked him, you know, he knows your stuff, you said, but he said, you know what? I just don't give smicha. I want to know what type of person you are as a character. So he said, well, Rabbi, I want to tell you that aside from my learning, I also go through strenuous deprivation exercises. Yeah, Rabbi was very impressed. He said, give me examples. He said, for example, I walk around with nails in my shoes. He says, I get myself, in order to keep myself humble, I get myself whipped every day. And aside from certain days of the week, all I have is water. So the rabbi, So he says, come with me. He goes with him to the window. Outside the window, there's a meadow there with horses that are grazing. So he points to the horse. He says, you see that horse there? Tacks in its shoes. All it has to drink is water. And every day when the rider rides it, it whips it. And this is noch als afert. In other words, remains a horse. So the fact that you have denied yourself doesn't say anything to me. It's the fulfillments that come from the denial that are the critical part. And in Judaism, if we're able to sort of mix the whole thing up together and say, okay, the denial points, which basically the key one is Yom Kippur, but I realize it's not denial for denial's sake, it's denial for fulfillment's sake. If I can do that with Yom Kippur, if I can do the same thing, for example, with Shabbos, a goy who keeps Shabbos is guilty of a capital crime. What's the capital crime in keeping Shabbos for a goy? Because a goy doesn't keep Zohar. The only thing he can keep on Shabbos, he's not going to be able to say, Boruch Atah Hashem, Boruch Pi Avgofen, because he's a goy. So what's he doing? He's just saying, you know what? Like the Jews, don't do this, that, and the other. I won't do this, that, and the other. But there's nothing in that. If that's all you're doing is denying yourself, there's got to be a fulfillment that comes attendant to it. If it's the one without the other, it's deficient. And that is true of everything. And that is true not only of the denials that are denials only, it's also true of the physical fulfillments, that they shouldn't be physical fulfillments only, they have to be physical fulfillments which are associated with meaning. And once we have reached the stage where we can combine the two, where we can use the ample opportunities, the Torah is full of opportunities and obligations to enjoy the world, to make the world a better place, to make it a better place for everybody else. The pleasures that we have, that we can take to the bank with us, the ones that we take with us when we leave this world, are not the pleasures that we enjoyed, it's the pleasures that we gave to others to make their lives more meaningful. Those are the things that are the ultimate pleasures. And when we do that, whether it's to pleasure God with studying God's word, whether it's to pleasure other individuals by bringing them happiness, ultimately in sharing with a spouse or with a community, this is the pleasure principle that gives us the best return, the best interest, not only in this world, but in the world to come. Thank you very much.
I'll say, ain simcha ela katharsis bekos. There's no simcha like getting a question resolved. We're going to have 2 or 3 minutes to have some quick questions resolved on our boca. There's 2 microphones, so at least one over here. If you have a question, brief question, please feel free to approach the mic. We have just about 2 or 3 minutes before we have to end this session. The mic is shot.
There's a race to the mic.
The simple question is that the topic was pleasure. Is there any room in Judaism for hedonism?
Which would mean, by your definition...
I'm not choosing to define hedonism. I'll let the professor use whatever...
No, but I thought that basically hedonism would be pleasure just basically for its own sake, and just living a life of pleasure. That would be absolutely sinful. Because it's important to enjoy, but the enjoyment is in the context. This is why the classic Rambam example of pleasure in the Yontif has to be combined with a sense of not just I'm in it for... conspicuous consumption, but to spread joy amongst others. So that type of a thing, which is eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we diet, or whatever it is, however it is, no, that would be totally un-Jewish. But Judaism is a lovely lifestyle of balance. Nihilism no good, hedonism no good, it's right smack in the middle. Yes?
I'm curious, and it's
good to be curious.
Dr. Laura, who had embraced Orthodoxy, and I think Judaism is fabulous, and returning to it myself. And, she gave up, on a radio show in August, she said she's no longer Orthodox, so it didn't do what she thought it was going to do. And I was very disappointed to hear that, because I think everything you've said today is really true. How would you respond to her? And I know you were...
I'll send her my tape of this. I was hoping to go through a day without hearing Dr. Laura. Well, what can you do? Actually, it was a disappointment for you. I'm sure it was a disappointment for many. For me, it was a personal disappointment on many levels, mainly because she had taken Judaism so seriously. And, the truth of the matter is, if I would bask in the credit when it was good, I have to take the blame when it's not. Her conversion was done in Ottawa, in our Beit Din. And it hurts when this happened on many levels. To this day, I can't tell you exactly what happened. I don't think anybody really knows. But I would share with you the idea that Judaism properly expressed is absolutely gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's what makes the world tick. The problems that we have in Jewish life are when Judaism is distorted. And I would suspect that some of the things that happened were the experiencing of Judaism that was somewhat distorted, and that gave birth to whatever problems. But I have to be very careful and say that we all go through crises in life. All of us have probably experienced a bad example of a Jew who didn't behave the way they were supposed to, a community that wasn't as sensitive as it should have been. This is not an excuse for leaving. It's a reason for trying even harder. And that has to be made clear. In other words, we want to try to explain individual situations that doesn't justify them. Yeah?
Rather than ask a question...
We have to end here. Sorry for not getting to your question.
I'm not going to ask a question.
Sorry, the next session...
I just want to
I'm sorry.
Yeah, all right.
The next session will start here in 3 minutes.
My uncle...